today's program. Welcome to all the members of the committee. And I think we do actually have a part of what we'll need to deal with before lunch today. Maybe Andrew can check the apologies from the members. For the apologies.
Chair, Ms. Yaku is still not apologizing for attending to party matters. She may come, but she may join the meeting later. And that's the only apology that I've received thus far, Chair.
Okay, we will confirm the apology. And looking at the agenda for today, we would actually look at the status report of the South African negotiations and implementation of all trade agreements, including the report of Brexit negotiations. So I think it will be a presentation that we think we'll be able to work on in the presence of Ambassador Xavier Karim, who's here with us, who's the Deputy Director General in the International Trade and Economic Development Division. Welcome, Mr. Karim. He'll be actually navigating us through the different areas of the presentation. The purpose of the meeting, though, is to provide with an overview then key relationship issue of South Africa engaging the trade partners, which actually is being exported and imported, and ratio of exports or imports in terms of the trade balance, the determination of the trade policy and agreements, supporting industrialization, and also I think raising the trading agreement of South Africa already entered into and the implementing of those agreements. And also I think we're looking at the advice, the committee on the ongoing negotiations and their status. So we actually have the ambassador working with us on that. So the further point on the agenda is actually the committee business. We're hoping that we can be able to give the draft program for the, you put it as last quarter? So for this calendar year, so which means it's actually third quarter. So that's the one we're actually looking at, and we're hoping that for each quarter we can be able to actually get the approval of what we're actually dealing with. And I think on our part we would actually look at what we have as an update on issues on our program. So I think it will be one agenda item where the ambassador will be working with us, and then on committee business we thought we'll have a look at the program. I'm sure you'll be comfortable for us to proceed that way. Hermans?
Good morning, Chair. I'm just checking maybe if I've misrepresented myself when I say which committee I serve. Is it and competition, trade industry and competition, is that our full title as a committee?
We deal with competition as a committee. We are a portfolio committee of trade and industry. Competition issues are part of the scope of work we oversee. Okay. Okay.
I think the department was renamed the Department of Trade and Industry and included competition as the rebranding of the department. I think Solo can confirm that.
Morning, honourable members. At the current moment, we have a Minister of Trade and Industry who has the Departments of Trade and Industry and Department of Economic Development that report to him. A new Department of Trade, Industry and Competition has also been established, but in actual fact, it will only come into effect next year once the two departments have merged.
I give very simple answers. In the presentation, I stick to that topic. And since I was requested to serve in this space, they said to me, Chairperson, Trade and Industry. So more than that, I will actually be in big trouble if I try and amend it. So until they actually get and decide, they'll go ahead and do that. So can we then actually see if our members are okay with today's program? Because on item 3 of our agenda, the 34-36 adoption of the agenda, can we proceed in that way, Mutawu?
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. I move for adoption of the agenda.
Okay. Can we hear from other members? Comfortable with that? It's more second.
Thank you, Chairperson. Seconded.
Okay. Can we then proceed to the next item and welcome the ambassador? We do have all the time, but I think for the committee, we won't be as late as yesterday. We should be able to break in time for lunch. And I just want to apologize for us working overtime. I didn't know that there will be so much passion in the presentation by the minister, and there will be so much enthusiasm of members to engage on the issues. Thank you very much, members. You showed your dedication. It's most appreciated. Ambassador, floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. It's a real honor to have the opportunity to provide a status report on South Africa's trade negotiations. we have the presentation is quite long in the way that it's set out, but I think there are some issues we could move fairly quickly through very short updates on, particularly on questions of implementation. The contents, I thought it's important to set out the negotiating principles and approach that has guided the work of the division that's responsible for our international trade negotiations and the approach that we adopt in the negotiations. But we also thought it was important to get an overview, a sense of our trade performance, particularly in the last 5 years, set out who are our major trading partners, a sense of the outlooks for the next few years, and cover that fairly briefly and then get into an update on the various negotiations that South Africa is involved in the WTO, on the African continent. There are implementation issues that we are dealing with in terms of our region's agreement with the European Union under the Economic Partnership Agreement. There's some matters to give the committee an update on our negotiations with the UK in the event that there is a Brexit. We've had a recent engagement with the US under the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA. There are implementation issues, very briefly, with the European Free Trade Area and the Latin American Regional Group, Mercosur. We thought it's also important, because it's so topical, to say a few words on digital trade matters that we will have to, I think, as a department, but also as a country, start to grapple with in a more systematic way. I should also say that at the back of the last slide of the presentation has the acronyms. Unfortunately, we in this work we have so many acronyms. Sometimes if someone was to ask me what it means, I wouldn't be able to remember. But we've got it. We've got them spelled out at the back on the last slide of the presentation. With respect to the principles and approach, there's a lot to be said, but I think the essential points are set out on the slide. Ever since, I think maybe almost 10 to 15 years now, ever since the Industrial Policy Action Plan began to evolve and it was developed and the various iterations, we've taken an approach where we're much clearer that our international trade and our negotiations need to give support to that. So it's industrial policy and industrial development objectives that inform South Africa's approach to our international trade
our negotiations, and that includes our negotiations on tariffs, so the amount of protection that we provide, and our efforts to get improved access into other markets are all shaped by our industrial development objectives. We aim in the negotiations to enhance our exports of higher value-added products. South Africa's trade is still dominated by mineral exports, but we want to see explore ways and open markets to export higher value-added manufactured products as part of our industrial development objectives. At the same time, in the negotiations, we are concerned to ensure that by engaging in negotiations, we don't expose sensitive sectors and industries to competition that could undermine either our employment objectives or our industrial capacity in different sectors. We're trying to ensure that we don't contribute to processes of deindustrialization in South Africa. In many of the negotiations, the negotiations involve taking on commitments that in one way or another affect the ability of government to implement policies. And so when we enter into these negotiations, and some of these policies go far beyond just a narrow trade agenda, they affect a range of services sectors, they affect our general regulations, intellectual property, investment regimes. So when we're in these negotiations, we're also aware that we need to preserve the policy space for the government to pursue developmental policies. A very core part of our negotiating approach, and this will come out in the course of the presentation, is the centrality that we give to our regional and continental integration agenda. So this is the negotiations on the continent to promote development, structural transformation, and industrialization across the continent. Turning to our trade performance, some numbers that are here, and I should at the outset always say that numbers can very often be disputed. The numbers that we're using are taken from the South African Revenue Service, from SARS, in many of our negotiations and many of our engagements, the data is disputed. So rather than focusing on the specific data in this, I think this is to give us an impression, an overall sense of how things have moved and how things are moving in terms of our overall trade performance. So from 2000 until 2018, South Africa's share of world trade has grown. It looks quite small, 0.45 to 0.53, but it's not insignificant. It's an overall improvement in our share of global trade. But over the last 5 years, as global trade growth has been slow, on average growing at about 1% per annum over the last 5 years up until 2018, we've seen South Africa's trade growth annually decline by 1.1% per annum over this period, the last five-year period ending in 2018. In U.S. dollar terms, so that gives a sense of how we've been. This is how we can compare ourselves to others. In terms of our total exports, there's a figure there of our total exports in 2018. But if you look over the last 5 years, the annual growth has been negative, 0.1% per annum, and this is largely explained by the dramatic decline in the prices of our mineral exports. So the value of our exports, mineral exports, have declined dramatically since about 2012, 2013, and that has affected the overall performance of the South African economy with respect to minerals, and then on in terms of our overall trade. And those export values have declined. declined much more significantly than manufacturing export values. On the import side, part of the explanation for the decline in overall trade has been the significant decline in oil prices, and oil accounts for a large part of South Africa's import bill, and as a result of the decline, that accounts for the decline in a large part of the decline in our imports. Of course, there are other products that will also contribute towards this. We have just set out our top trade partners over the last period, and that's specified there. What's China, the US, Germany, and Japan have always been major trading partners, but what's quite significant in this is to see that Namibia, one of the members of the Southern African Customs Union, is now in the top five of South Africa's export partners. On the import side, it's China, Germany, US, India, Saudi Arabia. If we take the EU as a block, of course the EU as a block is our biggest trading partner, but over time its share of South Africa's total trade has been declining. And the point I made about Namibia is you can extend it with the last bullet, and I apologize for the text falling outside the borders of the presentation, but it's Namibia, Botswana, Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, and Swaziland are now in our top 20. They rank in our top 20 of the top 20 trading partners. So it's quite a significant development. Africa is becoming much more important to South Africa's trade. So this is basically making the same points. Overall, our trade has declined in dollar terms, largely due to the end of the mineral export super cycle. Trade in goods is more or less balanced. We thought it's also important just to bear in mind that in terms of our total export export basket, 56.7% of our total exports are commodities, minerals, and our manufactured exports account for 42.9%. As I say, these figures can be disputed, but that's the general picture. We're more dependent on mineral exports than manufacturers. On the import side, it's the reverse. We import less commodities and much more manufactured products, and this slide also gives an indication of who are our main trading partners. And the important figure there probably is the importance of Africa to South Africa's manufactured exports. 35% of our total manufactured exports go to Africa, mainly in the Southern African region. A few points on the overall trade outlook, economic and trade outlook. I think we've been operating in an environment that has been characterized by weak global demand, sluggish growth, and with many downside risks to international trade. We've also seen in the last few years increasing backlash against globalization and particularly trade, and that has made trade negotiations in general more difficult to more difficult environment to work within. Over the last few years, particularly since the beginning of last year, we've seen a significant spike in trade restrictive measures that have led to what many commentators are referring to as a trade war between the big players, but that has an effect on overall trade and has had a direct effect in some specific instances on South Africa. The uncertainty that this has generated has also impacted on investment. And over the next period, we continue to anticipate low growth in the EU. There is a slight improvement expected from 1.3% this year to 1.6% next year. But the indications are that US will decline from what has been quite an important source of growth in the international economy, 2.6%, but declining to 1.9% next year. So those are the big economies in the north. Growth in developing Asia, developing countries in Asia, is expected at 6.2% over the next 2 years. By next year, and that is somewhat down from previous figures, but it's still respectable. African countries, 40% of African countries expect growth of over 5% in 2019. And with these few pockets of growth in the global economy, we can expect that that competition for access to those markets is likely to intensify. And in that respect, given the growth in Africa, South Africa is relatively well positioned to benefit from growth in Africa through the preferential arrangements that we already have in the Southern African Customs Union, in the Southern African Development Community, and new market access that can be anticipated through conclusion of the tripartite free trade area and the African continental free trade area. These are just some graphs showing our balance over the last decade or so. Again, this is just setting out all the main South Africa's top 20 export destinations. Another graph, our top 20 import sources. And then we'll move on to the first slide on the where we are in the various negotiations. And we started with the WTO in this presentation because the WTO sets the framework for global trade. But increasingly, you will see there's a growing crisis in the work of the WTO. If you try to unpack what the sources of this crisis are, it would start with a view from many, many developing countries that since 1994, when the WTO came into operation, that the rules were imbalanced, that they favored developed countries as opposed to developing countries. And this has been part of an ongoing challenge from within the system to reform the system in a way that promotes development countries' interests. But more recently, we've seen the widening backlash against trade. I'd mentioned this earlier. And now more and more citizens in Europe, in North America, are questioning the value of model of trade integration that had been pursued over the last couple of decades. Now, South Africa's position on all of this has been that we support a rules-based multilateral trading system in principle, but we recognize that WTO rules are imbalanced in many, many ways, and many of those rules prejudice developing countries' interests, and this is the basis for any future reform in the WTO should be to address that. We've set out a few principal points that we need a better balance between global rules and the space for governments to pursue national policies that advance development. We think that the balance has not been struck, has not been properly struck in the past negotiations. That WTO reform should foster inclusivity and development. It should focus on agricultural reform. And it should look at rules, re-look at the rules to open up space for industrial development and for technology transfer, which are essential in a developmental, with the development objectives in mind. And we've been working with many other like-minded countries in the WTO to pursue this agenda. When we look at the recent crisis, I've mentioned the backlash, and we've mentioned the long-standing concerns that developing countries have, but we entered a new phase at the beginning of 2018 in the challenges for the WTO. The first was in fairly early in the first quarter of 2018, the U.S. imposing tariff increases on steel and aluminum. Now, ordinarily, this would not be a problem, but the two factors that made this quite distinctive is that, first of all, that they went beyond the WTO legal bindings. So there are limits to how far you can increase your tariffs. You've made commitments in the WTO, legal commitments in the WTO on that. Those tariffs went beyond those legal limits. And it was on the basis of a rationale of national security, again, something that's entirely new in the WTO, and in that way can't be challenged. It's very difficult to challenge. There's no basis to challenge national security measures by governments. There is a challenge underway, but it's unlikely to be successful. The second impact of the way this measure was implemented is that some members of the WTO were given exemptions from those tariffs. So about five or six WTO members were exempted from those tariffs, not South Africa. And what that does is it breaks another cornerstone principle of the WTO, which is the most favored nation treatment, which means that you need to treat all WTO members in the same way. It's a cornerstone principle of the system. The retaliation from a number of members, particularly the European Union, China, and others, has triggered what we are now increasingly referring to as a trade war. So that's the one part of the recent crisis. In parallel to this, the U.S. has blocked the selection of members to the appellate body, which is the appeal body in disputes. It's the final arbitrary body in disputes under the WTO. And through a procedural mechanism, as members of the appellate body have had to leave, their terms were up. You need to go through a process of selecting replacements, and the U.S. has used a procedural intervention to block that. And what that has meant is that the seven-member appellate body is now down to three members, which is the minimum number needed to listen to appeals. And by December this year, if this is not dealt with, two more members will resign, and the appellate body will have no quorum and effectively will not be operational. Now, the appellate body is at the heart of what we refer to as the rules-based trading system. This is the body that ensures that rules are enforced, that rules are followed, and taking disabling it in this way means that the core of the rules-based trading system would have been disabled. And in future, we can expect that trade disputes won't be resolved through a due process, effectively a court system, but will be resolved through negotiations. And in those type of negotiations, powerful economies have more capacity to get outcomes that suit them. So this is a major shift. And by the end of December, we'll know whether or not we're in this new world. Another parallel development has been a series of proposals, particularly from developed countries, the US, the EU, Japan, working together, but also bringing in others, on a number of proposals that, in our view, would extend the imbalances and inequities that we'd raised previously. Again, there are many, many issues around it, many, many proposals, but if you were just to try to get to the essence of what is being proposed, it's about three or four key issues. One is that there are proposals that, in effect, would undermine consensus decision-making in the WTO. This has also been a fundamental principle of the WTO. And this would be done by legitimizing plurilateral agreements in areas where the full membership cannot agree. So what would happen in a normal negotiations is members would put forward an issue and they say they would like to negotiate, say, on digital trade. They'd like to negotiate rules on digital trade. You need all members to agree that, yes, we want to do that, and then you can start the negotiation. If they put forward a proposal on digital trade and other members say that they're not ready to negotiate, they need more time, etc., then under the normal procedure, you wouldn't be able to move. plurilateral agreements, proposals on plurilateral agreements, they would, if in effect, be able to move ahead with those countries that are ready to agree at this point in time. So what it does is it begins to fragment the multilateral nature of the system where everyone should be involved. It is negotiations amongst a small group of members in the WTO. The second big major intervention of a set of proposals is there's a principle in the WTO called special and differential treatment that favors developing countries. And it's to give developing countries a degree of flexibility in the commitments that they take in a negotiation. The proposal now is that this should be narrowed. It should not apply to all developing countries. One proposal was it should only be applied to the most vulnerable, least developed countries, but not to, for example, South Africa. Or that if you're going to apply it, it would be done on a case-by-case basis, which effectively means that if you want the flexibility, you have to have a special pleading. It's not a principle that's established in the negotiating process. And linked to this is the attempt to graduate some of the larger developing countries from from recourse to this principle. China's at the top of that list, India, Brazil, a number of others, and further down you'll see South Africa's name also appears as not requiring special flexibilities that are provided for in the current WTO system. Another set of proposals that haven't all been formalized very precisely as yet, but they've been raised at a broad level, which is to introduce new rules, further rules, on policies that would make government measures to support industrial development, to promote technology transfer, or to discipline the role of state-owned enterprises in the economy. And so those seem to be emerging. They haven't been specified in detail as yet, but we expect that those would be forthcoming. In large measure, this is targeted at China, but given the fact that we're in a multilateral system, it would apply to all developing countries, not just China. And this is clearly going to make the overall negotiations more difficult to conclude. There is one negotiation in the WTO which had appeared to have some possibility for an outcome, and the deadline for these negotiations was in December this year, in the area of disciplining subsidies provided for fisheries. And this is a UN Sustainable Development Goal 14, part of the broad framework of conservation and sustainable use of ocean, seas, and marine resources for sustainable development. And the WTO was to make a contribution to this by prohibiting subsidies to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, to constrain subsidies that lead to overfishing and overcapacity to fish, but at the same time would allow members the space to provide subsidies to provide space for those that provide low subsidies to develop their fishing industries, to allow subsidies for environmentally friendly or subsidies that allow more environmentally friendly sustainable fishing, and space to allow poor fishing communities to continue to receive support from the government. So this was the broad framework that had been set out to shape the negotiations on fisheries. South Africa played quite an important role in this. We have been working as part of the African, Caribbean, and Pacific group, and we have led that process at the technical level in preparing for the negotiations. I think we can, with a fair degree of certainty, suggest that there's little chance of conclusion by the deadline at the end of this year. There's still many wide differences between members on the definitions, on the matters that I raised, on the scope of the disciplines, and whether or not there could be some flexibilities for developing countries. now to the African agenda. I'd mentioned a number of times that Africa now accounts for a growing share of South Africa's trade, particularly in terms of manufactured exports. But we've long argued that the constraints for Africa's development is its small fragmented markets and over-dependence on commodity exports, much like South Africa, and that we have poor infrastructure linking up the economies, African economies. And on the basis of that, we've also long adopted and advocated a what we refer to as a developmental integration approach to regional integration that combines combines three types of interventions. Negotiations to reduce tariffs to open markets through free trade agreements, cooperation between governments and by sectors and business to develop industrial development to build the supply capacity and develop regional value chains across Africa and to promote economic diversification, and at the same time look at how we could strengthen cross-border infrastructure linkages. I think the most important point that comes out of this is just simply opening up markets in Africa is not sufficient. What is required is African countries need to build up the ability to take advantage of more open markets by building up their productive capacity, their supply capacity, and that essentially it means industrial policy, agricultural policy that helps you move up the economic value chain. Africa, some of the motivations for pursuing African integration is that Africa has a large market, a billion plus people, a large GDP, a growing middle class that is increasingly consuming more. And so this is the source of, great deal of the source of growth in Africa, and this signals the importance of Africa for trade. With respect to the African Continental Free Trade Area, we pursued this as a significant contributing factor to integrating African markets, to helping to boost intra-Africa trade, to create larger markets also provide the basis for scale economies, for firms to operate on a bigger scale, to export to the entire continent. It should encourage investment into Africa, and the AFCFTA will enhance legal certainty if there's this rules-based system underpinned by an effective dispute settlement mechanism, and that provides the kind of certainty that allows investment to flourish and to take advantage of the continental market. Where we are in this process, a couple of years ago, 54, which is all African Union members, have signed on to the AFCFTA. Of the 54, 27 have ratified the agreement, which means that it has legal force. The Parliament, would be aware that South Africa deposited its instrument of ratification on the 10th of February this year. And on the 30th of May, the agreement entered into force. The negotiations have been structured in two phases. Phase one would be negotiations on trade in goods, which is the tariff reduction schedule, rules of origin, which is an intrinsic part of a negotiation, as well as rules to deal with non-tariff barriers, cooperation on customs controls, measures to facilitate trade and transit, and a commitment to negotiate a framework for trade in services. Where we are is that the legal texts on the first phase issues are largely completed. There are one or two technical issues that need to be finalized, but there are two major gaps in this. One is the an agreement on the rules of origin, specifically with respect to the rules as they relate to sugar, to autos and textiles and clothing, and that these need to be finalized by February next year. The other major gap in concluding this is that we need to now settle the tariff schedules that countries are going to follow in terms of reducing the tariff reductions. We've agreed at a broad level that the tariff commitments would be such that starting in July next year, there would be a phase down over 5 years to zero of 90% of all tariffs. So South Africa would take on this commitment, but so would all other members, African Union members, with some adjustment for least developed countries. But effectively, we start next year, we reduce tariffs over 5 years from July next year to zero, and by that way we also have access to the African market, improved access to African markets. The date for submitting our schedule is February next year, so we've got quite a lot of work to do to try to meet that that deadline over the next period. Similarly with services, there's a sense that we would need to submit to adopt for adoption at the AU summit in February next year, a list of scheduled commitments for trading services. This looks like it's lagging at the moment. Very little work has been done. It's a very complex area. We'll have to see how that unfolds. There's a phase two in the negotiations which comes after, and these would be protocols for continental rules on intellectual property rights protection, on competition policy, on investment, and that's in January 2021. So a very ambitious set of objectives. Whether or not we're able to meet all of these, we need to see, but certainly we're committed to working towards these in the next year or so. In the course of discussions, both at the continental level but also at the domestic level, a number of concerns have been raised. We've had concerns raised about the level of ambition, that the 90% is really very high, and that's just the first phase. There's another phase where over the next 5 years we would have to reduce tariffs on another 7% to zero. So there's a concern that the ambition is too high for tariff liberalization. South African constituencies at this stage have only agreed on submitting a list of 86%, so there's work to be done there. Some import competing sectors have concerns that industrial capacity would be lost. Some sensitive sectors like textiles and clothing, there are concerns about implications for employment. So those are concerns that have been raised. More widely, there's a concern of growing transshipment where products that not necessarily from other African countries but from third parties outside of Africa could simply establish some kind of a operation in the African continent and transship through those operations to the South African market. So you need proper controls, customs controls, proper management and monitoring of rules of origin to ensure that. So that's been raised as a concern, and I think the department and the minister have been in close consultations with stakeholders and South African revenue services to see how we deal with this issue. We're also seeing that there could be risks of non-implementation. So where South Africa would implement the commitments, we're not entirely sure whether everyone will implement the commitments. What we've seen in the SADC context, for instance, is that there are instances where some of our trading partners have implemented non-tariff barriers to block South African exports. We've seen this in Zambia, in Zimbabwe, Tanzania, amongst others, at different times. And those are quite difficult to deal with. Suppose the main point to make in this is that in this respect, trade liberalization, trade agreements are only sustainable in the longer term if the benefits are seen to be shared equitably. So that is a concern. Now, before the launch of the Continental Free Trade Area from about 2011, we were working much more intently on the tripartite free trade area, which is an arrangement between SADC, Southern Africa, COMESA, which is East Africa, and the East African community within COMESA. We were working on a negotiation process with those countries. And that had advanced fairly, advanced quite well at the time. It was much more explicit in the way of setting up an integration agenda that had the elements that we mentioned about development integration, that it needs, that trade liberalization needs to be complemented with industrial cooperation and infrastructural development. So it was much more explicit in adopting that approach. It also had the two phases of negotiations. The legal texts have been concluded. The agreement has been ratified by a number of countries. We need a total of 14 countries for it to enter into force, which means 9 countries still need to ratify it. And the level of ambition in terms of the tariff phase down was much more reasonable, much more easy to manage. That's set out there. Modalities for tariff negotiations were 60% at the start of the process, 25% over 5 to 8 years, leaving 15 for future negotiations. In order to conclude this effectively, we need probably just one more negotiation as the Southern African Customs Union, and that's with Egypt. Obviously, Egypt we've not been able to engage with them over the last few years, and so this has been a gap in the process. But if we were to conclude that, then in effect, the tariff regime negotiations would be concluded. But there are also rules of origin that still need to be finalized, and it's the same as in the CFTA, very sensitive sectors of sugar, autos, textiles, and clothing. I'll move on to the Southern African Customs Union, and the main point to make here is that, a few key points is that SACU remains an important market for South Africa. I mentioned that all of the members, at least four of the members, three of the members are in our top 20 of trading partners or export markets. The agreement is long-standing. The SACU agreement is from 2004, but it's based on an agreement that goes back to 1910, based on a common external tariff. So we all apply the same tariffs for the union. There's free flow of goods within the union, and there's a redistributive revenue that's established, a mechanism that's established that the revenue is put into a pool and then it's shared and it favors the smaller members. Under this process of review, which has been ongoing since about 2011-2012, we've been advocating an approach to the to SACU that would go more in line with the development integration approach. What we've been promoting, what we've been advocating, is that we use a portion of the common revenue fund for industrial and infrastructural purposes to build supply capacity and infrastructure across SACU. This has been countered by other colleagues in other members in SACU who are much more concerned on looking at the way SACU manages tariffs in Southern Africa, and that tariffs would be set by consensus. Differences in economic size, differences in our policy imperatives, how we see how to apply tariffs, and the objectives, those differences have led to an impasse in the review. And so I think the outcome of all of that is that the status quo, as it had been prior to the review, is likely to remain. In SADC, if we move on, we have a free trade area that's been in place since 2000. The agreement is fully implemented. A number of countries, SADC countries, have not joined in. Angola, DRC, and Comoros still to join. But for the 13, for those 13 countries, the implementation is ongoing. One important point is the point I raised earlier, is that Zimbabwe has been concerned that it needs to introduce some protection, exemptions from tariff liberalization for quite a number of products to support its domestic production. And so this has been an ongoing debate within SADC. There are current discussions on advancing the negotiations on trade and services in those four sectors, and another two, or they're completed on the four sectors. Negotiations on energy and construction are ongoing. And there is a framework for regional industrialization that has been agreed. The SADC EU Economic Partnership Agreement, and it's a bit of a misnomer to call it the SADC EU. In fact, it's not SADC as the 13 countries or 15 countries that we talked about. It's SACU plus Mozambique. But we had to follow an EU template on this. But so it's called the SADC EU Economic Partnership Agreement. It's been in force since the 10th of October 2016, and the tariff regime is in place, and the tariffs are the implementation is underway. The main issue to bring up here is that that SACU imposed a safeguard measure against EU poultry imports. They imposed it last year, so it's effectively we removed the preference that we give them for poultry imports, and we've implemented a tariff of about 35% against poultry imports that will be reduced over 4 years, essentially to protect the domestic industry. This is a legitimate measure. It's part of the agreement. We followed the due process. That measure is in place. A few months ago, maybe 2 months ago, the EU has signaled that it wants consultations, possibly towards challenging the validity of the measure, and there will be some discussions later this week to see where that goes, if they're going to pursue the arbitration. There are a number of other issues which we have on the table to have for discussions with the EU, but I needn't get into them now because these are just open. These are issues that are on the table that we're not going to that are still going to be subject for further discussions. Similarly, with the implementation, other implementation agreements, the SACU European Free Trade FTA, there's an ongoing review. There's a discussion on whether or not we could expand market access to those countries. These are sort of the non-EU European countries, so it's Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Iceland, Norway. It's a much smaller agreement in that sense. And so there's an ongoing discussion on whether or not we can build on what we had concluded in about 2008. We have an agreement with the Latin American Mercosur countries. This is a limited agreement, and it's in place. There's very little discussion about expanding that at the moment. Brexit and the question of whether or not we'll have a new Southern African Community, Mozambique, UK agreement. This is probably a better name. It's more accurate than the SADC EU EPA. This is SACU and Mozambique and the UK Economic Partnership. First point is that the UK is an important trading partner for South Africa. So this is taking into account both imports and exports. They are the fifth. The question of, we obviously we had to start to think very carefully about what would happen if the UK was to leave the EU, what would it mean for our negotiations. And the principal point that was agreed in the initial discussions that if the UK was to leave, what we should be working towards is essentially replicating the terms of the agreement under the SADC EU EPA to be applied between Southern African countries and the UK separately. So essentially a rollover of current treatment. Now, I suppose all of us have been following the discussion. We're not quite sure whether or not the UK will actually leave. But this agreement would be an insurance against any disruption in trade if they were to leave. If they were to leave at the end of October or in January, if that was the case, this would be insurance to ensure that the trade would increase. If the UK decides to leave the EU but stays within some of the trade terms, such as the customs union, then there wouldn't be a need for any change for this agreement. But in effect, what we've done is we've been working towards is to have an insurance against a hard Brexit that would have an impact on South Africa. I see when we prepared the submission, the chances of a hard Brexit appear to have increased. If I was to rewrite it today, I would have said something a little bit different. But in any case, we're working towards ensuring that there's no disruption on that. This explains a little bit why this slide explains a little bit why there would be an impact on South Africa on our exports if the UK was to leave and didn't have anything in place. The UK had published a list of a new tariff regime if it was to leave the UK, leave the EU. And on that list, it has largely given duty-free, quota-free access to everyone, except on 114 product lines, and those would affect South African exports of autos, textiles and clothing, and sugar. We estimated that it would affect trade of around 7 billion rand a year of our exports. It would also affect the UK in terms of having to face new tariffs in SACU. And so that was the motivation for working to negotiate this deal. We've been working on a number of issues. I mean, by and large, it was a relatively easy negotiation in the sense of rolling over what was in the SADC EPA into this, but there were some specific issues that needed to be taken into account, particularly with respect to the rules of origin, how UK would address health and safety regulations for food in future. We understand how it works in the EU. You're not sure how it will work with the UK in future, so we needed to ensure that we had a degree of comfort on that. And an important issue that had emerged more recently is how you manage the safeguard that had been taken against EU poultry if the UK leaves. That effectively that should be transitioned into the new agreement. This is some of the specifics of the engagement with the UK. I suppose one important point to bring out of this is, according to the way the agreements will be set up, the UK would continue to be able to use imports from the EU in its production processes and export that as UK product to our region. UK insisted on this because obviously their production processes are deeply integrated into European production. So many of the parts of cars, for instance, come from the rest of Europe, put into building the car in the UK and then exported our region. And we do the same. We take parts from Europe, put it into our production processes here, and those are exported to the UK and elsewhere. So we wanted to make sure that those value chains are not disrupted by that. So to some extent, we've solved that problem, but it doesn't answer the question of what happens between the UK and the EU. And we need to see what comes out of, what type of deal comes out of that. One of the implications of the UK leaving the EU is that while we can accumulate with goods from the EU for export to the UK, we can't take goods from the UK into our production processes and export to the EU. The SADC-EPA agreement doesn't allow that, so that's a disruption to that will be a disruption to our trade if it's not addressed. We have been working to conclude the negotiations. There's been progress that has been made. There are still some consultations to be done. I understand there's been a request for the minister to come and brief Parliament on that, and I believe that there would be that briefing would take place fairly soon. So that's where we are now. I thought I'd just map out the process, some of the issues that have come up, and I think you'll have an opportunity to engage with the minister soon. About a few weeks ago, maybe about 4 weeks ago now, we had an engagement with the U.S. In Abidjan as part of African countries that benefit from the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And this was an important meeting in getting a sense of what the future holds for our trade relations with the U.S. It's important to sort of break down in this way to understand how we export to the U.S. We export under three different trading regimes. The MFN, which is the regime that the U.S. applies to everyone, and that's what that's in the, set out in the WTO, is one regime, and 72% of our exports go to the U.S. under that regime, and that's pretty well established. It's mainly commodities. Then there's a general system of trade, general system of preferences that the U.S. Offers to many developing countries, which is also an improvement over their over what the other tariffs that they apply to the rest of the world. And under that regime, about 10% of South Africa's exports go under that. And these are some auto products and some other manufactured value-added products. The GSP regime works in a way where every year the U.S. Congress has to review it, whether or not to continue to extend those preferences to developing countries. And the problem with that is it inhibits investment, because investors would like to have a sense that if they're going to invest and export to the U.S., they know that it's for a period of time. The short review period is an inhibits investment to use the GSP effectively. The African Growth and Opportunity Act, one of the great advantages of the African Growth and Opportunity Act was that the review cycle was extended for 10 years. And that meant that investors could come in and invest, would have a sense that they'd have this preferential access to the U.S. market for 10 years at least, with the possibility of it being extended. And that was to give a greater degree of certainty to increase investment. The AGOA regime also added an additional 1,600 products that were duty-free to sub-Saharan African countries. And this saw a really significant increase in South Africa's exports to the U.S. from when this came in. It would have been in 2001, 2002, if I'm not mistaken. And our exports peaked in 2008 at about $3.8 billion U.S. dollars. But since then, and this is the next slide, the our exports and trade with the U.S. has been on a steady decline. AGOA accounted for about 36% of our total exports at one point. It's now down to 27%. It's still important, but it's obviously declining. At the last extension of AGOA a few years ago, South Africa was removed from was made subject to what they term in their regime an out-of-cycle review, which means at any time South Africa could be asked to explain this or that policy, trade policy, intellectual property, investment, whatever the case may be. And being subject to the out-of-cycle review undermined the certainty that investors would have. Now, that together with some of the other threats on the future of the tariff regime, we mentioned earlier steel and aluminum tariffs that were applied against South Africa, the threat of our tariffs on autos, U.S. threat of tariffs in autos, has seen a significant decline in our tariff, in our exports of autos to the U.S. In 2018. So a decline of 51% in 1 year. This is some of the factors shaping our trade with the U.S. At the meeting, the U.S. again indicated that AGOA would end in 2025. They are saying if it continues, it certainly wouldn't continue but in the same framework, and it certainly wouldn't extend to all the countries that have had access to it in Africa. They're proposing a new framework, sort of built in terms of new legislation that is that the U.S. has implemented, a piece of legislation called Prosper Africa, which is effectively an attempt to coordinate U.S. government activities and work with a focus on Africa. They've got that. They've passed that. There's a new Build Act, which is an attempt to mobilize U.S. private sector for investment and trade in Africa. So again, this speaks to the point that was made earlier that some of the few areas of growth in the world, we're going to see increased competition for that, and Africa is certainly one. And from these, you can see the U.S. is preparing for a stronger interaction and engagement in Africa. The U.S. in the engagement says message that comes across is that they're going to incentivize their firms to support African development, but that they need African governments to make changes to their regime, make their regimes more investment friendly, less restrictions, reduce restrictions on the operations of U.S. Firms. At that meeting, the U.S. also joined in the chorus of supporting the African Continental Free Trade Area, but also signaled that it wanted to pursue a free trade agreement with the one African country that would be a model for others. So while supporting the African integration agenda, at the same time they made this proposal. There was a general response. I don't think it's a final word on the matter, but the ministers from a number of African countries gave a response to this overall picture. I mean, many highlighted that AGOA was very important, but it had not fulfilled its promises, and that had to do with Africa's lack of capacity to take advantage of the U.S. market, and also stringent U.S. product standards make it difficult to export. Many of them talked about the priority for Africa, which now be operationalization and consolidation of the AFCFTA. And some went as far as saying that the FTA with a third party could undermine the continental agenda or distract from that priority work. So this is going to be an ongoing discussion. This is my last slide, I'm happy to say. This is on digital trade. this is an area I think that we're all beginning to grapple with in a more sustained manner. And what we've done here is just simply put down a few considerations that we think deserve attention as we move forward. I mean, what we've seen is that there is a rapid process of digital transformation across the world. It's affecting the way we produce, the way we consume, the way we trade. But this transformation is very uneven. It's far advanced in developed countries, in industrial countries, in the north, in China, some other Asian countries, but it's many African countries lag and many other developing countries lag in this process. It is going to impact on our industrial production processes. It's going to impact on trade. It will have implications for employment. And so we need to prepare a comprehensive and coherent response to these challenges. Clearly, there are advantages, great potential in harnessing this new technology for economic development and social development. But technological change on this scale can be extremely disruptive. And so we need to be focused on that. Some of the, in the debate, particularly in the WTO, some of the points that come up over and again is the persistence of the digital divide that operates along many dimensions. So the notion that everyone will benefit equally from this, or that there are no problems with this, needs to take into account the digital divide. There's a lack of adequate and affordable digital infrastructure amongst many countries, particularly in Africa. We also are very aware that we have a comparatively weak digital skills base. When we look around the world and look at what is happening in different jurisdictions, we see that there's a lot of work that is going into strengthening competition policy to address what is seen as very high concentration, highly concentrated markets in the digital economy, and rising incidences of anti-competitive practices. So in particular in the European Union, they're using competition policy to try to discipline the way digital firms operate in their economies. There's also a lot of work that's been going into trying to address the tax base erosion that is being aggravated by digitalization, the fact that digital companies do not seem to pay the same amount of taxes as other firms. This is also related to a discussion that's going on in the WTO on a moratorium that has long been in place against customs duties for electronic transmissions. This has been in place since 1999, and essentially it is an undertaking that governments won't apply customs duties on electronic transmissions. Work that is coming out now is beginning to say, well, as more and more products are traded electronically, the impact on government revenues may have been underestimated, and I think we're beginning to see some of that now. So there are questions of whether or not this moratorium should be renewed at the end of this year when it comes up, when that decision needs to be taken. There has been, in the course of these discussions about digital trade, quite a lot of focus on free data flows. And in Europe, for instance, in the US, the general view that you need to keep data flowing freely. This is good for the global economy. The internet is free. Data should just flow. But there are concerns about implications for privacy. There are implications for national security. And so countries are beginning to implement those types of policies to manage free data flows with some other important society values. But what has been missing from this debate for a long time is the role of data and data flows and what it means for economic development. We often talk about data being the new oil in this digital economy. Maybe it's not oil in the same way, but it's certainly a critical value how do we ensure that we harness that data to support development. And the minister has been making this point in some of his interactions, is that we need to become innovators, producers, exporting services and building capabilities for economic inclusion and growth through this digital transformation. I think the main point that we're calling for at this stage is that we need a dialogue, a more systematic dialogue on some of these matters between stakeholders in South Africa. And I think I'm done. So thank you very much for your attention. Apologies for taking so long.
The presentation, I'm sure, would be accepted, Ambassador. We will actually then take a quick break, 15 minutes, just to actually have some refreshment. Then we can come back and pick up. I think we may have to open discussion on what we have here, besides because I can see that I can't really speak to this point. It looks like the issues are so integrated. You actually would be allowed as a member just to pick up on issues which I think of interest, because we're trying to actually just be in line with what's actually happening. So can we actually take a 15 minutes break and then reconvene? Thank you.